the other organizers who asked me to be on this program, and also let me welcome all of you. Some of you I know, and some of you I don't know, and I hope by the end of the week I will know all of you. And let me just talk a little bit about angiogenesis. This connection between biochemistry and mathematics goes back a lot further than me. This talk is organized along a tutorial paper which my collaborator Mark Nelson Hamilton and I wrote for. Abner Friedman, actually, which has appeared in Tutorials in Mathematical Biosciences, Cell Cycle Proliferation and Cancer. And this will appear, but I'll make the presentation available to the organizers. So anyway, that's the main reference. And here is a sort of an overview of the talk. First of all, I want to talk from the point of view of an ignoramus about some of the biological and biochemical underpinnings of angiogenesis. So the first part of the paper was written, obviously, by the biochemist. Okay. The second part of the paper was written primarily by me, and I'm going to show you this new model, but I'm not going to show you any simulations from the new model because we haven't done it. Okay. If there's time, I'm going to show you some results from a model for tumor angiogenesis upon which the new model eventually is an outgrowth. So I'm not sure I'm going to get there, but we'll see. Okay. So what is angiogenesis? What are the key events in angiogenesis? What are the chemical and cellular contributions to capillary structure? Endothelial cells, of course, form the capillary wall. Pericytes, cells surround the endothelial cells and provide structural and functional support. The basement lamina encloses the endothelial cells and pericytes. There are more underpinnings. There's the interaction of endothelial cells with their environment. There are the events, extracellular events, which lead to vascularization. Soluble proteins that alter the environment and influence the endothelial cell function. Proteases and protease inhibitors, for example. Then there are factors that stimulate angiogenesis, often called growth factors, of course. And there are even more underpinnings. There are inhibitors of angiogenesis, and we want to talk also about cellular events that characterize angiogenesis, such as proliferation, apoptosis, and migration. And finally, there are the intracellular signal transduction, that regulates cellular events. And I think we're underpinned, at least for this talk. That's a lot of stuff, actually, you know. And to do that in detail, you know, I get all the talks. Okay, I don't want all the talks. Okay, but anyway. So I'm going to show you now a sequence of transparencies that sort of try to give you some kind of biochemical feel for what went on, what goes on. So this one I took from, this is a sequence of figures. Here you see a vessel lined with endothelial cells, and here you see some capillaries. The area inside the cell inside the vessel is called the lumen. And here you see a branch network. In addition to growing, of course, sometimes there can be pruning. These branches get pruned. Of course, that's anti-angiogenesis, so there has to be some kind of signaling for that, too. And here is another picture of a capillary. So here is a picture that I took from Carl Rakuzan's book on coronary angiogenesis when I was first learning about it. He had a very nice review article. certainly long before me. So here you have the lumen, here you have the pericyte cells on the outside, and the macrophages, and the mast cells. So the mast cells control inflammation, and the macrophages are the body's policemen, inside you, here are the endothelial cells lining the capillary, and here are the platelets, and that's a typical capillary, that's a normal capillary. And so let's look at what sort of goes on with angiogenesis. In angiogenesis, of course, you get the invasion. So here's the cross section of a capillary. In angiogenesis, you get the beginnings of an invasion of a single cell towards some source of growth factor or following some trail of growth factor. And eventually you get lumen formation, and then you get proliferation at the tip, and it continues to grow. Okay. So the model I want to talk about. Pardon?
It might be useful to the audience if you made sure they understood if it's a cross section or a holmen. So like what the perspective is.
Oh yeah, this is so yeah. So you know, if you think of a capillary as a cylinder like that, then we're looking at the end. So here is. Okay. Is that okay? So I'm looking. So as opposed to the previous slide, where I was looking at the longitudinal segment. Is that clear, everybody? Thank you. So, what I'm drawing is somehow a sprout forming here and then going. Okay. So what happens, of course, is that the proliferation of the cells is down at the tip, and these guys then become quiescent. And so the model I'm going to propose today is how to distinguish between these two types of cells, even though they're the same cell type. I mean, they're in different states, and I want to distinguish between those. That was something I didn't understand very well in the beginnings of working on it. You have cell death, and that's can it be either apoptosis or programmed cell death, or in necrosis, which is cell death, but not in an organized way. And so the picture is, the way to understand the difference is you get chromatin condensation and blebbing and fragmentation, and this is a cell undergoing apoptosis, whereas with lysis or the breaking up of bonds, you get swelling and the cell looks like this in the death, in the dying state. Yeah.
There's another / survival or death choice, which is autophagy. I don't know if you're.
No, I'm not familiar with that. You have to tell us about that.
Well, I'm not even sure. Maybe Charlie might want to. I don't know. There's any evidence as yet it has anything to do with vascular phenomena, but it is another possible thing, which is it is very complicated. It's very poorly understood. But my understanding is that it can be both a survival mechanism where, under stressful situations, which will definitely involve angiogenesis, cells will try to survive by cannibalizing their own internal organelles, but then ultimately this is another way to undergo death, and it involves a totally different pathway.
Than either one of those two.
As far as I understand, anybody else want to comment? It's really quite fascinating and just beginning to be
understood.
And while apoptosis is a very important part of some of these vascular phenomena, I don't know yet of anything.
Not in the embryo. I study embryos, so they're busily trying not to die, I suppose.
Okay, and now one of the structural elements of the extracellular matrix is fibronectin, and I've sort of drawn and this is a very important protein. Structural protein. It turns out that mice with the fibronectin gene inactivated die before they even get started, which I found a rather interesting fact. But anyway, it looks something like this, and there is an RGD sequence where the integrins on the cell bind to the matrix protein, So this is kind of a scary looking picture if you're not a biochemist. But basically these ovals are certain domains of amino acids of varying kinds. And the fibronectin molecule is linked with a bridge here. collagen is another matrix protein with which endothelial cells interact. They form triple helices called protomers, and I'll show you the slide in a minute. These assemble into complexes in the extracellular matrix, and we can see what they add. Endostatin, well, I want to talk about endostatin. That's a fragment of collagen. And so here's what you have. You have alpha 1, alpha 2, alpha 3, alpha 4, alpha 5, and alpha 6. These are amino acid chains of collagen, and they can form these triple coils. So here's an alpha 1, alpha 2, alpha 1 coil, an alpha 3, alpha 4, alpha 5 coil, or an alpha 5, alpha 6, alpha 5 coil. And here you and here you see this one is an alpha 1, alpha 2, alpha 1 coil. And then they gather together and then they form the collagenous structure. A piece of one of these is endostatin, which can function as an angiogenesis inhibitor. And I'm going to say more about that from a mathematical point of view in a minute. Finally, there's the cell cycle. Like, that's not important, right? So the current thinking, I'm told, by them that knows, is that growth factors or the lack thereof regulate movement in and out of this cycle. So since growth factors play a very, that's not surprising since the growth factors play a big role in angiogenesis also. So in our proposed new model, I want to exploit this. I want to think of this as a chemical diagram, just the way you think of A to B and back and forth like that. I want to think of this as a chemistry equation too. And so if you have growth factors, you go in. If you don't have growth factors, you go out. And I want to put that in the model. Okay. Then, of course, there's VGF signaling. Here's vascular endothelial cell growth factor. It binds to this, and this is the cell surface here. It binds to a VGF receptor, and that initiates this long signal cascade. Which every time I ask somebody what are the rate constants, nobody knows. eventually, resulting in the activation of AP1. Transcription factor, which then induces transcription and translation of a protease, which then gets outside and then proceeds to degrade the matrix, thus providing a hole for this lumen to move through, for the cell itself to move through. And that's the theory behind the angiogenesis in a nutshell. Okay. So the surface of a membrane is a complicated place. I didn't really understand this 5 or 6 years ago. I thought, well, I'm just a cell, that's a round little thing to draw. Okay. But it's amazing to me that this, so you have various classes of receptors. Here is the extracellular side. This is the membrane. And this is the intracellular side. And these are the tyrosine kinase portions of the cell receptor. Here is, I think this one is a VGF receptor class. There are several of them. There are a bunch of other ones. And each of these groups, of course, are marred as conveniently labeled here for me. These are the various groups that form the pieces of the receptor. So she showed me a micrograph of a cell once and in one of her earlier talks, and it doesn't look like a smooth soccer ball at all. Looks like a hairy sphere somehow. Like I looked before I had, when I had hair, okay? All curly and wiggly all over the place. So that's the image to keep. Okay. So this is just a discussion of the binding sites. Now I want to talk about inhibiting angiogenesis. I have used tumor-induced angiogenesis here, but it doesn't have to be. So you can either inhibit protease, that'll stop the ECM from getting carved up, or you can use antibodies against VGF or against VGF receptors and the integrins that will prevent, if you block the integrins, of course, then they can't grab onto anything. Or you can try to inhibit the autophosphorylation of VGF, or you can soak it up with heparin, or you can use endostatins and other related inhibitors, or you can try to inhibit certain cell functions associated with angiogenesis by inhibiting proton pumps. And that figure is sort of here. So here, so here I have a tumor cell, and here I have an endothelial cell. And this guy is pumping out growth factor, and it's being soaked up by one or the other of these various sites. So you see there are various possibilities for anti-angiogenesis. So here is, for example, this molecule PD173074, which I know you're all familiar with. This guy is an inhibitor of tyrosine kinase activity of fibroblast growth factor, FGF, and the EGF growth factors growth factor receptors. So here is, I don't remember, which one is the north, the south, the east, and the west? Which one is the when you do these, these kinds of pictures?
Mm.
Western. It's a Western block. Western. There's north, south, east, and west, and I never remember which one goes with which one type of molecule. So, but I did learn it once. It's okay. I did learn it once. Anyway, so now I want to tell you, I'm right on schedule. I've used 1/3 of the talk for biochemistry. Okay. So now I want to talk about this proposed new model. Okay. So the talk is going to get kind of mathy now. Okay. Okay. So this is. Never use light green. Discrete versus continuum models, okay, of angiogenesis. So this is a question of scale, really. Whether you want to model things as a continuum or as discrete cells, as discrete individuals. Being a PDE boy, I prefer continuum models. Okay. Unfortunately, one of the first things I learned is there isn't any universal model for angiogenesis. Okay, or biology. Period. So, and probably that's a good thing because those models would probably be so big and complicated that they would be of limited usefulness. Already you see this with signal transduction. Try to write down all these ordinary differential equations that describe the pathway, you get 40 or 50 DEs, and nobody knows the rate constant, so how good is that? Okay, so it's incompletely understood, and from one point of view that's really good because that means a lot of papers. Okay, so modeling becomes a moving target in this case. And to some mathematicians, that's very frustrating. Well, once I got tenure, it didn't bother me. Okay. A good model, of course, as Marit says, should predict testable hypotheses. And when I started working with her, she would say to me, I'd show her something, and she'd say, make the mathematics tell me something I don't already know. I'll try. Okay. And that's what we continue to strive for. Make the mathematics be predictive as well as descriptive. And that's a big job. Okay. So our approach is to look at biochemical kinetics and population modeling. And I like to take this as I think of the cells as, you're going to get really upset when I say this next word, as electrons. I mean, I like to think of electrons. Electrons are not particles, right? They're probabilities, probability densities. And so that's the way I like to think of the cell density, as a probability density, okay? So that's a continuum model, okay? And that, okay, so what are the model constituents? Well, we have chemical kinetics, in the simplification of intracellular events. Okay, I'll show you how we do that. Then there's the role of the cell cycle, how that plays. say that in the earlier work that we did, this could have been done better. But that's research, right? I mean, you learn as you go. Then I want to talk about chemotaxis, haptotaxis, and something called chemokinesis. Let me just say something about chemokinesis. That's sometimes used as that's a word that means that not only is the motion dependent on the gradient of a chemical, but also upon its concentration. I'm just going to lump this in with chemotaxis.
How are you defining haptotaxis?
That's a sort of the mechanical movement in it. So at the pseudopodia, you look for the right concentration of matrix to grab onto. But mathematically, there's no difference between these two. It's a gradient movement.
Mm-hmm.
It's movement toward a preferred gradient. So I don't really like this word either, any more than I like this word, because it's just a different form, as you'll see in a minute. It's mathematically, it means the same thing.
But you see chemokinesis and chemotaxis as two independent?
Well, let me show you what I mean in symbols. Finally, I want to talk about contact inhibition, crowding, and one way to model them. Okay. So what are the biochemical ingredients of this model? There's growth factor. It binds to a receptor, forms an intermediate that results in an intracellular cascade that results in cell expression of one or more molecules of an enzyme and initiates cell division. Protease degrades the collagen matrix, resulting in peptide fragments, PEP prime, etc., at least one of which has an inhibiting effect by interfering with growth factor receptor, growth factor receptor, or the collagenase, the protease, by blocking further production of C by binding with growth factor. The growth factor receptor complex. That's a kind of a negative feedback. And finally, inhibitors may be introduced to the system intravenously. So now let me write this down in chemical equations so that you maybe can see. So I just want to make some notation clear here. So if X is a molecule in an active state, we call it X of A. Okay? And if otherwise it's in an if it is in an inhibited state, and we write X sub I. Okay. So in the model that I just, in the previous transparency which I just described, you have an active growth factor molecule binding with a receptor to produce a growth factor receptor complex. Then this complex takes resources from the cell or from the cell and the exterior environment. And produces several molecules of an enzyme, a protease, and a deactivated molecule of growth factor and a receptor. So if you stare at this pair of chemical equations, it looks like the receptor is behaving like an enzyme. So all of this whole thing is the cyclic transduction cascade. That's the whole. Then, of course, what happens is the protease interacts with the matrix collagen or fibronectin, either fibronectin or collagen or both, to form a complex. That complex degrades into here's the protease functioning as the enzyme, and then various fragments. Okay, one of these fragments is going to function as an inhibitor. Endostatin is among these fragments. And we'll see how that acts in a moment. So that's the loop. The Michaelis-Menten hypothesis is assumed to be enforced for both of them. So it's just a way to, I mean, from a mathematician's point of view, it's just a way to relate the concentration of the intermediates to the individual concentrations. But this is a saying that I assume everybody knows what this says. It says that the intermediate forms and goes to steady state rather quickly. Okay, so what are the types of inhibition that one can have? You can can have competitive inhibition, so in which, for example, the inhibitor blocks the receptor. That's one form of inhibition. Another form of inhibition is to have the inhibitor blocking the growth factor. Okay. And of course, to be really an inhibitor of the previous mechanism, these constants have to, this reaction has to be far to, both of these equilibria have to be far to the right. And, or you could block the enzyme. So these are three examples of such. So this is competition with the enzyme. So in this case, the enzyme was the receptor, and in this case, it was the growth factor, and in this case, it's the protease itself. So that's why I have quotes around enzyme. Now you can have non-competitive inhibition. That's the other form that I find in the biochemistry textbooks. And there, the inhibitor is competing with the competing with the intermediate and deactivating the intermediate. And there are two ways here for the for that particular mechanism that I described before. It looks like I've got the same equation twice, but it's really not, as you'll see. And finally, you have the competition this way. The inhibitor competing with the intermediate in the fibronectin protease complex. Okay. So I'm going to just write down the mass action for each of these. Okay. So you can, in competitive equilibrium you get three equations, in non-competitive equilibrium you get two equations, but three equations also, but they're a little different. Okay. And finally, you have mass conservation. So the total number of receptors is the active receptors, the inhibited receptors, and those that are busy up bound in the complex. And similarly for growth factor, and for non-competitive equilibrium, you have these two equations. The total intermediate is the active intermediate plus the inert intermediate. Well, that's a lot of equations for me to discuss in one story, and I've already used half my time for theory here. But so I'm going to look at the case of which the one case which in just talk about one case and what you get when you interfere with the growth factor. So it's this guy. What the mathematics comes up for that guy. So the resulting enzyme degrades the collagen matrix, and amongst the products of the, is a competitive inhibitor of growth factor, namely IG. And if you write down the differential equations for that set of reactions, you get this set of equations. So here's the growth factor being absorbed. This is the resulting enzyme being produced, active enzyme being produced. And then this is the degradation of the collagen from the fibronectin. And finally, and here is, this is the degradation of the collagen. This is the production of the inhibitor. Okay. So the proteins have a finite half-life, and they're imposed on the diffusion of these guys. And a term is included that reflects the capacity for cell expression of collagen. So we have some choices for the independent for the dependent variables. So if you choose this pool, namely if you choose total G, total C, total receptor, total collagen, and total inhibitor, then you have to relate that back to the active form of these guys. And so you can get these guys, the active form of these guys, from the conservation laws, just by doing that in the Michaelis-Menten hypothesis. So that's these are some algebraic equations that you get from that. Now I want to also point out that where's the cell density? And the cell density is related to the receptor density in this very nice way, I think, and I learned from Mark. If you have a number of receptors per cell, and you have a number of receptors in micromoles per liter, then if you do the bookkeeping carefully as I've done it, you can relate the number of receptors the number of receptors per cell to the number of cells by this little formula R max over N max. 1 over N max is the carrying capacity and the volume of a cell, a single cell. So this relates receptor density to cell density. So that's how we tie the cells to the receptors. Yes, ma'am.
Sir, but does that take into consideration that these receptors are in a very dynamic state and the cells would be very heterogeneous with regard to receptors per cell surface and depending on the
this is a function, R is a function of position. So there's still spatial distribution here.
But the receptors turn over quite differently depending on the situation.
Right. And you see that in the cell densities change too.
Not necessarily.
Well, point wise. You'll see. Yeah, I mean, in some sense, I mean, it's a simplification also, right? It's a model. So, I mean, there are certain things that get neglected, and maybe I'm neglecting that. I don't know.
Okay.
I think I need to talk to you about that.
I was just wondering. I mean, for example, you can have a static vascular bed, but due to certain
But that's a kind of a steady state. It's a homeostasis or what is it?
Well, you might have internalization of receptors.
Right.
And those receptors might never be actually recovered in the cell surface, or you might have a situation in which you do have incorporation of newly synthesized receptor as well as recycling. So it's complex, and it could be very rapidly changing depending on the conditions. So, yeah, R is very variable.
But what kind of time are we talking about?
Seconds.
Yeah. And this is like several hours.
And I think the position of the endothelial cells will have.
It will change. So depending on the cell, you know, if you're talking about a hip cell or a column cell, very likely you're going to have different dynamics of receptors. So, you know, generalizing for the entire process is. But, you know, you got to start somewhere. I understand your.
So that, I mean, yeah, I mean, there are subtleties. But this was just, I mean, this idea was just somehow to relate the cells, the cell population to the receptor population. And that's the question.
Well, maybe I can rephrase for you. I may be wrong because I'm unlike these ladies, I'm not a molecular biologist, but I think what you're saying maybe is if you take a snapshot, in this case of tumor environment, let's say, is that right? Take a snapshot of the tumor environment at any given time, and you look at all at a little block of tissue. You look at lots of tumors, and you look at lots of times in the lives of tumors. You kind of have there's sort of a generalized density of tumor cells, and there's sort of a generalized density of vascular cells. And although there's variation, you kind of pathologists spend their lives doing this, and they sort of know what they're looking at. Is that fair? Is that what you're?
Yeah, I mean, in a sense, a PDE is a kind of ergodic. Averaging over lots of, as a kind of an ensemble, just the way a rate equation is, really. I mean, an equilibrium equation is an ensemble average of lots of molecular events. I think that's probably the way to look at this model, anyway.
I mean, they wouldn't, these two very famous molecular biologists, they wouldn't be confused. They would know what they're looking at. I mean, they would know they're not looking at kidney. You know, tubules or muscle, or brain tissue. They would recognize what you're talking about here. I think that's what you're saying. I'm overstating.
Well, I put my mathematics cap on. Okay, then I would say that these are equations that are kind of averages over large numbers of experiments. And that's good.
And just maybe to play with a little bit better. The question is, to what extent do the receptors that are expressed on the cell at any one time represent the number of cells? And if some cells, the receptors are going down and being internalized, and some you might be going up, and on average, you might have, you know, 50% of the receptors are actually expressed, and, you know, so
well, Well, I mean, this is an average equation, right? The number of cells per unit volume that you have corresponds, this is the number of receptors per unit volume. Okay, now that can change with time, because even though this may not change with time, but over a long time, the idea is that it's a kind of an
So how far can you be an hour?
I don't know.
Yeah.
Well, some things are happening in the order of, if the seconds we're talking about, then, and I want to write down a model that talks about 18 hours to 2 weeks, then what's a second? Among friends.
Yeah.
Anyway, there's certainly a lot more to this business than I purport to know. So anyway, if you do a rough calculation, you find that typically the maximum number of receptors on a cell is of the order 1 to 2 micromoles. That turns out, I thought that was really nice, because that means I can take receptors equal cells. Okay, now I want to talk about the role of the cell cycle here. So typically what one has, in my little scheme of thinking about a tube growing out from a given capillary, the ones behind aren't growing, and the ones ahead are growing, and so the idea was to take the logistic equation and say, well, my population of cells consists of active cells and inert cells. And so to model the active cells, the proliferating ones, I have the growth factor. I have a kind of a sigmoidal increase in the coefficient that allows for proliferation, namely this logistic term here. And so this is a function of growth factor. Of course, that guy goes up to some limit. And the more growth factor is around, the fewer inert cells are around. So the larger GA is, then the smaller this coefficient is, and that drives down the production of inert cells. So that's the idea. So if GA is small, most of the cells are either inert or they die out. So yeah.
Well, I don't understand. I would expect that there would be some change of active cells to inactive cells.
Coming.
Oh, sorry.
That's fair enough. That's coming, yeah. So how do we put that in the model, right?
Right.
Yeah, okay, so I'm gonna do that right now.
Okay.
That's a good question. Okay, so there it is, okay? So this is a hypothesis, and pay attention, Khalid, because this was a mistake in the model, in the paper, okay? The switching is done by active growth factor against some threshold. And so here you see is if the growth factor is large enough, you have inactive cells going to active cells. Oh, H, what is H? H is the mathematician's switch. Okay, named after Mr. Heaviside. Okay, so this is X, and this is H of X. So H of X is 1 if X is positive, and 0 if X is negative. So if the active growth factor concentration is bigger than a threshold, then we are switching inactive cells to the active state, and switching, and then this is zero. This term is zero. Okay, and so for the other one, it's exactly the other way around. So now you see, when the growth factor is large, then you're losing inactive cells and you're gaining active cells. So that's the new wrinkle. So the new wrinkle I propose in angiogenesis, in modeling angiogenesis, is that you divide the cell population into two populations, active ones and inactive ones, to reflect the cell type cycle, and you have your logistic growth and death, and then you have the switching business. And so that's the proposal. All right, now I just want to remind you of something everybody knows here. Okay, this is Fick's law, okay. Classical Brownian motion. If the medium isn't isotropic, then you have to replace D by a 3 by 3 matrix that reflects the structure of the medium, and one of the speakers or two of the speakers are going to do that in a slightly different way. I haven't done this, but others have, and I see there is a left parenthesis. No, no, I guess so. No, yeah, this guy shouldn't be here. Anyway, so D may be positioned so this now becomes a matrix, and this is a vector, and so now the flux is a vector which may not be in the same direction as the gradient of the cells. So that's a reflection of the change of the structure on the cell movement. And for chemotaxis and apotaxis, then you do something like this. Let me write the whole thing down here. And so you have the Brownian term. This is the Brownian diffusion, and then you have the growth factor chemotaxis vector. So this is the gradient in chemotaxis, and the listing of all these variables here is the chemokinesis, basically. It's the fact that the movement in the direction of growth factor can depend on F, G, G, C, F, and possibly the cell density. And haptotaxis is just flux containing a term which is proportional to the gradient in fibronectin. So if you look at those things from a mathematical point of view, these are all essentially the same form, but different, I mean, they're just different labels, okay? So so that becomes the new flux.
Is the protease chemotaxis?
Pardon?
Is that matrix protease?
Yeah, that's in here too, yeah. That's
so you say that the cells are chemotaxis?
They could be chemotactic to that, yeah.
Is there
I believe. I would hate to be pushed right now, but I believe.
Yeah,
I mean, they're creating a hole, right? They're creating a hole, and in that sense, the cells want to follow that. So
you don't see it as a result of the chemotactic gradient?
Well, it's very interesting when you do the modeling. I mean, if you you can get similar results if you suppress this one or you suppress that one.
Mm-hmm.
Let me show you. Anyway, this is a proposal. And then all times the cell density.
Okay.
If you had a potential function, so that the coefficient G could be written like this, the coefficient M could be written like this, and the coefficient F could be written like this, then you can write that single equation in a nice simple form like this with a logarithm. And the meaning of the logarithm is that this, you can think of this as a fugacity or as a chemical activity. Okay, this is a free energy expression. So even though the equation looks rather funny in that form, you can think of it as a fugacity coefficient or as an activity coefficient. Okay. Sometimes the term for this coefficient is probability transition function, which is a term used by Davis and Othmer and Stevens for that same type of term. The usual assumption is made that the cells respond independently to G, C, and F, so that this fugacity or activity coefficient is just the product of functions like that, and then and that the response in each factor is unimodal. That is to say, it's first increasing and then decreasing. So if you have if you fix C and F for the moment, the idea is that as G increases, the response, the cell density increases. And then as G continues to increase, the response of the cell density then decreases. The movement response then decreases. And similarly for the enzyme and for the fibronectin. Okay. How one chooses these is, of course, a subject of debate, okay, and experiment. It has to be settled in the lab. Okay. So Sandy's right. I mean, there has to be experimental evidence. But so far we know, I mean, I do know of experimental evidence for this from a paper that you cited. And I know experimental evidence for this, and off the top of my head, I don't know, but I here is another wrinkle, contact inhibition and crowding, and how to model them. So these are ideas we stole from Kevin and Tom Hillen. Suppose the cells move randomly, but the random motion is influenced by the local constant gradient. So you have two species, and the motion is influenced by local concentration and gradient of each species. Then the flux of the first species, in terms of cell density, is given by an expression like this. Okay, it's proportional to its gradient and also the gradient of the neighbor. Okay, this coefficient can be either positive or negative. So if you allow these coefficients to change sign, then when the product of these two coefficients is the same sign, then the gradients cooperate in driving the flux. And when these have opposite sign, when these two have opposite sign, then they work in opposition to each other, these two gradients, in driving the flux of J1. Okay. you can think of, for example, when D11 is negative, the cells self-attract. Anyway, the continuity equation leads to something like this for both systems. And then, so this is a kind of a horrible system, so maybe we can simplify it a little bit. So what we did was we said, well, all right, suppose, I think what Kevin and Tom Hillen did was to say, suppose there's a scalar field D1 such that this vector field, so here's a vector field, consists of two components. So that vector field is exact in a certain triangular region. So that's just the curl condition, right? That's what I mean by exactness. then you can write, if you write down, so you say, here's the curl condition, says that this is the gradient of something else. So if you write that down and beat it to death, then you find that the two differential equations take a nice form. And you notice they have a log in. Okay, and so again, you can think of this potential function for the DIJs as a free energy correction in both cases. All right, so you have the ubiquitous logarithm. So I want to make a comment about chemical potential. Usually you see something written like this, where C is the concentration. So C is some species, concentration of some species, you see this written down. This can't be correct, because you have to put, in front of this logarithm, you have to put a dimensionless quantity. So the correct expression is to have some reference state, C over C zero. That's the correct thermodynamics. Okay. So if you take, for example, this kind of a product for your fugacity, eta I, say, let's say we had eta 1 here, just okay. 1 minus the sum eta 1 over n 1, eta 2 over n 2, where these are the carrying capacities of species 1 and species 2, respectively. Then when eta 2 is 0, you see, you for small eta 1, you would expect the cell density to follow itself, and for eta 1 near the carrying capacity, you would expect this to be small again. And similarly, so, and of course, if you have some eta 2 in there, you get an inhibiting effect of eta 2 on this fugacity coefficient. Okay. So then you see eta I will follow this guy near equilibrium, because in order to drive the system to equilibrium, you need that ratio to be a constant. The other one is fixed, eta tau I first increases and then decreases. Okay. Okay, so that is, the cells tend to aggregate at low density and de-aggregate near the carrying capacity. That's what all this mathematical mumbo jumbo says. They will tend to aggregate when at low density. This is poorly worded. I stare at tech too long. So basically the idea is that when the density is low, the cells want to aggregate, and when the density is high, they want to de-aggregate. That's what the mathematics is saying. So, but But you can't always do such a reduction because you can't always have an exact equation. Okay, and this gets worse in three dimensions. Okay, so now we have our final set of equations. Cells in G0 express growth factor, active cells moved by growth factor, protease and collagen gradients, and contact inhibition. Quiescent cells moved by gradient, collagen gradients, and contact inhibition. The cell movement coefficients are constant. There is a threshold growth factor GE and transfer rates. And now you have these partial differential equations for the cells. So here's this free energy business for the cell movement, and then you have these transfers that we talked about before, and we have the algebraic relationships between them, between the active and total forms, as I said before, and finally we have the biochemical PDEs. So that's a system that we want to try, okay, that we believe will get us to the state of where we have inert, inactive cells behind the growing cells, behind the tip. That's what I believe this model will show. Okay. Of course, it's descriptive again, but it's worth a shot at it anyway. It better be descriptive in the first instance. Yes, ma'am? Yeah.
But they are migrating?
No, they don't migrate.
In the equation it was,
yeah.
They move via,
yeah, they do move, well, they have to move some, but they don't migrate. Let's go back and see what the hypothesis is. It looks like their migration depends only upon their density, their neighbor's density in the surrounding tissue. Whereas these guys will move in response to growth factor. And or matrix. Sandy?
I have a question about that. It looks like you put the quiescent cells proliferate.
Here you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, but the larger the growth factor, the less the proliferation. But it's a good point. It's a good point. I and I'm not, like I say, I'm not really sure about this. Okay. It may be that this term shouldn't be here at all. But just to be a production term, just that everything should come, just that everything should come from here. Okay, so I don't know. Okay, so all right. So let me show you some results from a related model. Okay, so this is a paper that appeared in the Journal of Math Biology in 2001. So you recall, many people have seen this diagram of Fulkman where you have a tumor and you have a capillary, and the tumor secretes growth factors and the capillary grows back toward the tumor. So that's the kind of thing we wanted to model. So we took here, a tumor region, a capillary down here, and we asked what happened, and we lined this guy with endothelia, and we wrote down a model that connected these two. And I'm not going to write down all the equations, but you need two sets of variables. You need a set of variables for the capillary wall, and you need a set of variables for the extracellular matrix. And we found the following. In the no angiostatin case, if there was no inhibitor, then you got very good agreement with the experimental results of Fulkman and his colleagues, as well as with CAM assay experiments. Chalowitz were in agreement with known densities. Let me show you some of the figures since we're running out of time here. So here you start with an extracellular matrix. The tumor is over here, and here you see the endothelial cell density is moving across. You have some tip proliferation, and that looks pretty good. You see the fibronectin is being carved up by a channel, forming a channel. You can see that the chemotactic effect here. The tumor is, this is the capillary side. This is a distribution of growth factor, and you can see that as time goes on, the growth factor is being consumed just in a certain central region based on the chemotaxis. This is protease. It's a similar story to the endothelial cell density. And you can then also look at what's happening to the these densities in the equation, in the capillary. So the little, okay, so these are the densities along the capillary wall. If you put an angiostatin, the opening from the mother capillary closes, the EC density in the daughter capillary drops, the tip retreats, and the channel closes. And so here you can see what's happening. So right at the end here, we stuck in some capillary, in the mother capillary over here, we introduced some angiostatin and allowed it to diffuse. And you see with time, it shuts off the endothelial cell connection to the wall, and eventually all the endothelial cells disappear. And here is the capillary, the fibronectin, and you see when you put the angiostatin in, it wants to close off the wall here. Eventually it does, and then that guy shrinks away. And similar to the time course for the protease, the protease itself is still there in plenty of volume, although it does shrink away, decay away, but the active protease really goes away very rapidly. Here you see the scale here is from 0 to 15 in units, and here it's from 0 to 2 times 10 to the minus 3 in units after about 16 days. So the active protease is being destroyed by the inhibitor in this particular model. The VEGF, of course, goes away also. It comes to a steady state. And that's the cell density in the capillary. You see the capillary is closing up. Cell density, fibronectin density. The hole is closing up. Okay, and so then you have a list. So what we did was we took a look at the numbers, the distance from the capillary to the tumor in microns, and we scaled and we calculated the number of hours that it took, and then we looked at the mean velocity, and then we extrapolated these times to 1 millimeter. So I should say the distance in that little model was something like something like a length of 50 microns, 25 microns this way, and then we scaled it up to 1 millimeter and 2 millimeters, and the number of, and then the times went to days, and these are within the right ballpark of Fulkman's numbers for his experiments, plus or minus 30%. And then, so that's the end.